You should hear me now. Yep. Okay, good. Now that's my mistake. I forgot to hit the unmute button. So we're all set now. Are there any questions before we start? Because the quiz is a week from today, and I sent the review session and past quizzes you could look at. So that's just a reminder. And I hate to be a nag, but as soon as you start to get numbers in your companies, if you could go into that shared Google spreadsheet and enter the numbers, that'd be great. Rizwana, question?
Yes, Professor. So the quiz will only contain the portion from the packet 2 and up to what you teach in the lecture today.
Yes.
Thank you.
So it'll be through slide 140 something, so you know, which we'll get through today. Kathleen, you have a question? No, just your mic's just live. Okay. Okay, so let's pick up where we left off. Any other questions? I'm sorry, I don't mean to bulldoze you. No? Okay. So last session we were talking about designing the perfect debt for your company. And if you remember, the key here is very simple. You want to design something that looks like equity around you. It's got the flexibility of equity and the tax benefits of debt. So I said the start of the process in designing debt is to look at the business. You look at the projects it takes, are they long-term or short-term? What currency are the cash flows in? Now, how does inflation play out in your cash flows? Do you have pricing power? And by the time you answer those questions, you should have a very good sense of what the right kind of debt for your company is. That's why I'm always wary of cookbook approaches to debt, where people say, well, it worked for that company, why shouldn't it work for me? Well, because you're a different company, different kinds of projects. So now let's continue with this process. You've designed the perfect debt for your company. You've stopped and made sure that it passes the tax test. In other words, that it gives you the tax benefits. Here's the third stop, and it's a tricky one. There are different interest groups you've got to keep happy as a company, right? You've got investors, equity investors, and equity research analysts. You've got ratings agencies, and sometimes you have regulatory authorities. And a security that makes one group happy can make another group unhappy. Let me explain. If you're a ratings agency, your focus is on default risk. So you want companies to increase their equity because if they issue debt, they're increasing their default risk. If you're an equity research analyst, you don't want a company to issue shares because when they issue shares, you have dilution, you have more shares outstanding. So wouldn't it be great if you create a security that the ratings agency thinks is equity, but the equity research analyst thinks is debt? In other words, you'd like to make a stop at the ratings agency, hey guys, we're going to be raising $100 million in financing next year. And by the way, it's equity. So the ratings agency is happy and says, okay, your risk went down. And then you make a stop at the equity research analyst and you convince them that the same security that this morning was equity with the ratings agency has magically become debt. And if you're a regulated companies want you to have equity. You know, I'm talking about banking regulators, insurance company regulators, because equity makes it risky. So if you want to make a third stop and convince the regulatory authorities that the security that started this morning as equity in the ratings agency became debt in the middle of the day with equity research analysts is back to being equity again. This is mind-spinning, right? You're saying, how can the same security be equity to one group and debt to another? I hate to be cynical, but a lot of what Wall Street has been doing for the last 50 years has been designing securities that are different things. They're like shape-shifting securities. They're different things for different groups. Let me give you a very simple example. About 30 years ago, some banker, I mean, the parentage of the security is kind of in doubt. You know, nobody's quite sure where it came from. Some banker somewhere, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, invented a security called trust preferred stock. Let me describe trust preferred stock to you. And based on my description, I want you to tell me whether you put it in the debt bucket or the equity bucket. So here's what trust preferred stock looks like. It comes with a fixed dividend payment. In other words, a dividend is set up front. So unlike traditional equity, where a dividend is a residual payment, where dividends can change, in trust preferred, it's a fixed percentage. Second, that fixed dividend is tax deductible. And third, if you fail to make that fixed dividend, trust preferred shareholders actually get voting rights in the company. They get control of the company. Fixed dividend, tax deductible, loss of control. If I asked you to classify this company as debt or equity, remember how the distinction between debt and equity? which bucket would you put it into, debt or equity? Anybody? Rizwana said debt, Ketriel says debt. Looks like debt, right? Fixed payment, tax deductible, loss of control. And if you think about how we thought about debt and equity, this looks like debt. And here's where the banker pulled off a coup. He managed to get the ratings agencies to classify it as equity. He said, how did he do it? I actually talked to one of the people who sat on the committee of the ratings agency that classified it as equity. And I said, why do you guys treat this as equity? It doesn't look like equity. And he gave me two reasons why they treat it as equity. One incredibly stupid and one mildly stupid. I'll give you the incredibly stupid reason first. He said it was called preferred stock. Hey, that's an opening you've given me, right? You classify something as debt or equity based on what it's called. I'm going to go on a renaming convention on my balance sheet. I don't have bank loans. I'm going to call them bank preferred stock. Or corporate bonds. Let's not call them corporate bonds. Let's call them corporate preferred stock. That's the incredibly stupid reason, in case you're wondering. And then he gave me the mildly stupid reason. He said, trust preferred stock is perpetual. And that's true. It doesn't come with a finite maturity date. He said, debt usually has a finite maturity date. Equity is the perpetual security. Because it had a perpetual life, we treated it as equity. That seems to make a little more sense, right? But remember last session, I said Boeing was one of two companies to issue 100-year bonds in the late 1990s. Think about it. If you have a 100-year bond and you buy the bond at the time of issue, are you going to be around for the maturity date? Unless you're an incredibly optimistic human being, you're going to be dead, I'm going to be dead well before this bond matures. Do you see where I'm going? If you can issue 100-year bonds, why can't you issue 1,000-year bonds? Why can't you issue perpetual bonds? In fact, there used to be bonds called console bonds that the British government and the Canadian government issued, which were console bonds. Console bonds don't have maturity date. If you're going to classify something as equity based on the fact that it does not have a finite maturity date, my advice to Boeing is issue perpetual bonds. The ratings agencies will actually give you a higher rating as you issue more debt. You might have to pay a higher interest rate. But it's still a stupid reason. There's really no good reason to treat this as equity. But as long as trust preferred was treated as equity, bankers push companies to issue trust preferred. And you can see why, right? You're borrowing money, that fixed dividend, and it's tax deductible. But while you're borrowing money, what happens? The ratings agency keeps pushing up your ratings, saying you're getting safer and safer. This seems like the best of all worlds. So in the early 1990s, there was this rush in investment banking to get companies to issue trust preferred. So let's say this is 1994. You just graduated. You got a job at Goldman Sachs. Your managing director says, I want you to sell as much trust preferred as you can. You know why, right? The commissions on trust preferred were vastly higher for bankers than the commissions on common stock or a straight bonds. So your mission is to sell trust preferred. So you're going to make a lot of bonuses if you can sell trust preferred. But at the same time, you don't want to do damage to your clients, the companies that come in for advice. So I'm going to give you two companies that come in for advice. And I want you to tell me which company, given that you want to push trust preferred, which of these two companies would you do less damage by pushing them to issue trust preferred? The first company is underlevered. They have debt capacity, but they're choosing not to borrow money because they have a constraint. What kind of constraint? When we talked about companies having rating constraints and not borrowing as much as they can because of, you know, a rating constraint. So the first company is underlevered, it has debt capacity. And you can get them to issue trust preferred. And if they issue trust preferred, they can preserve their rating and borrow money. That way, they're killing two birds with one stone. The second company is overlevered, but it might be able to slide under the radar and issue trust preferred. And the ratings agency might not punish them by lowering their rating. So which of these two companies is a better candidate for trust preferred? The company with too little debt, the underlevered company, or the overlevered company? Rizwana, you said over-levered. You are the exception, so I'm going to make you, put you on the spot. Why would you want the over-levered company? Do you should trust preferred?
Well, ideally, the over-levered company would want to go towards it if it wants to move towards its optimal ratio.
But remember, its optimal is lowered. It has to have a lower debt ratio. This way, you're increasing your debt ratio by using trust preferred because it's really debt, right?
But it's still called equity, so it'll still be
You,
classified as
I'll
equity.
tell you what the only consolation prize you'll have is you go bankrupt with a really good rating. The end game here is not to have a good rating, it's to survive, right? So you might be able to fool the ratings agency by issuing trust preferred. They might still give you a triple B rating because they don't see that you've created a fixed obligation. But remember what over-levered means. You're already having trouble making your debt payments. And what have I done? I've added another commitment on top of that. So when you're over-levered, the last thing you want to do is to go out and create more commitments that you got to meet. So actually, the company that you should be pushing the trust preferred on is the under-levered company because it does have debt capacity. It can service those dividends without putting itself into trouble. But the problem was, if you were a banker and you were pushing trust preferred on everybody, you forgot what the end game was. A lot of companies seem to think the end game in issuing, in raising financing is to fool the ratings agency. They think, hey, if I fool the ratings agency, I'm winning. But the reality is you got to survive. You want to keep default risk under control to survive. And unfortunately, the end game gets forgotten as people start to think about, hey, what can I do? I'll tell you what happened with Trust Preferred. There's a story here. In 1993-94, Trust Preferred was treated as equity and companies issued Trust Preferred. In 1998, I think, a company that had issued a lot of Trust Preferred actually went bankrupt. And ratings agencies woke up and said, oh my God, this is not equity, it's debt. So starting in the late 90s, they started shifting trust preferred from equity to debt. So the game was over with trust preferred. So guess what bankers devised? They devised more complex securities to make it so that the bankers wouldn't see that they were borrowing money. In fact, now they talk about degrees of separation. What they were doing was creating more and more complex ways of borrowing money where people couldn't see that you borrowed money. 2 degrees of separation, 3 degrees of separation, 4 degrees of separation. And you keep pushing this game. You know what it's going to look like at the end? It's going to look like Enron. Now, Enron is a story that's been told and retold, but I'm convinced that if you'd walked into Enron headquarters in the late 90s and you walked into the CFO's office at Enron and said, how much money do you owe? I'm convinced that they wouldn't have known how much they owe. They created so many degrees of separation with special purpose entities and complex securities that Enron would not have known how much they'd borrowed. And that's a very dangerous place for a company to be. If you don't know how much you borrow, trust me, you're asking for trouble somewhere along the way. So as you go out there, some of you are going to go work in corporate finance departments and investment banks, and you're going to find more and more complex securities being created. Some of these complex securities have good rationales. Some of these complex securities are designed to fool ratings agencies. And be careful. If you're playing that game, that you're not fooling yourself as a and your clients by doing this, because you could be creating default risk that brings your company down. Banks have created a whole range of these securities because they're trying to fool regulatory authorities so that they can be counted as Tier 1 capital. So European banks in particular have come up with these really, really, really complicated securities that are really not equity, but they're treated as Tier 1 capital. So I think sometimes simpler is better because then at least you know how much danger you're in. By creating these complexities, you just expose yourself to more danger. Any questions on this third step? So the third step is a step where you're trying to keep different interest groups happy. There's nothing wrong with doing that. Just don't get carried away and make this your end game of fooling different interest groups, because sooner or later, it's going to come back to bite you. Any questions? Now you're almost there, right? You've devised the perfect debt. You made sure it met the tax requirements, so you get the tax benefit. You've tried to keep different interest groups reasonably happy. You get ready to issue the bond and you discover that nobody wants to buy your bonds. You say, why wouldn't people want to buy my bonds? For two reasons. One is you've issued bonds before, but you have a bad history. I'll give you an example. Remember at the start of this class, I talked about RJ and Nabisco, how in the late 1980s, they took their bondholders to the cleaners in an LBO, where essentially they did a leverage buyout and ripped off their bondholders. That was 1988. 4 years later, so they went private, you know, KKR took them private. 4 years later, Nabisco went back public and tried to issue bonds again. And nobody would buy Nabisco bonds. And you can see why, right? Bondholders said, look, we remember what you did to us last time. We're not buying your bonds. You ripped us off. So the first reason people might not buy your bonds is because you have a history, but it's a wrong history. The second reason people might not buy your bonds is you're a company that's never issued bonds before. You have no history in the bond market. So sometimes bondholders are worried about buying your bonds because they don't know what you will do with the bonds. So what do you have to do? You might have to sugarcoat the bonds. Give the bondholders some protection so they feel okay buying these bonds. Let me give you some examples of how companies can sugarcoat bonds. In the late 80s, Merrill Lynch came up with these bonds called rating sensitive bonds. You're saying, what are rating sensitive bonds? So the way bonds usually work is you issue the bonds, you set a coupon rate. The coupon rate stays the same over the life of the bond. That's what got the Nabisco bondholders into trouble, right? Because when the bonds were issued in the early 80s, Nabisco was a AA rated company. But when the LBO happened, it became a BB rated company and the coupon rate stayed the same. So in a rating sensitive bond, here's what happens. The coupon rate is set at the time the bond is issued based on the actual rating at the time of the issue. If 3 years later, the company's rating drops, the coupon rate adjusts upwards to reflect the lower rating. It's an attempt to keep bondholders protected. You're saying, why would a company want to do it? The company doesn't want to do it, but let's say bondholders won't buy your bonds because they're afraid you'll pull a Nabisco on them. Do a leverage buyout. What can you do? You can put that protection in, and that way the bondholders buy your bonds knowing that if you do something crazy and your rating drops, their coupon rate will get adjusted. I talked about puttable bonds, where if you do something like a leverage buyout, bondholders can put the bond back to you. A lot of bonds after the Nabisco fiasco became convertible bonds. You're saying, how does it help bondholders? Remember, in a leverage buyout, equity investors are ripping off bondholders. You know what a conversion option gives you? It gives you a chance to become an equity investor. Basically, you're telling equity investors, if you try to rip me off, I'll become one of you, and who will you have to rip off? So essentially, when you look at adding protections to bonds, you're doing them because you want bondholders to buy your bonds. And this way, you provide the protection. So when you see companies adding features to bonds to protect bondholders, they're not doing it out of the goodness of their hearts. They're doing it because without those protections, people will not buy their bonds. So that's the fourth step. You add enough protections to your bonds so bondholders will buy your bonds. Any questions on that step? Which brings me to my final step. So you've devised the perfect bond. You've checked for the tax to get the tax benefits. You're keeping different interest groups happy. You've added enough sugar coating to the bond so bondholders feel willing to buy your bond. You get ready to issue the bond and you realize the market's made a mistake. In what sense? The market's overestimating your risk. In what form? Well, remember when you issue bonds, the coupon rate in the bond is set on your bond rating. Let's say the ratings agencies have underrated you as a company. You know what I mean by underrated? You should really be a single A rated company, but the ratings agencies are giving you a double B rating. If you go out and issue the bonds today, the coupon rate has to be set based on the double B rating. You're going to pay too high an interest rate on the bond. You're saying, what should I do? Even if the right bond for you is a long-term bond, my suggestion is use bridge financing, short-term debt, until you can get the ratings agency to see things your way. That might never happen, in which case you're in trouble. But essentially, if you have a market mistake that works against you, you don't want to lock that market mistake in for the next 20 or 30 years. So if you feel you're being underrated, that ratings agency in the market are not seeing your true default risk, they're overestimating the default risk, you might hold back on issuing bonds. I'll tell you, this is not a minor issue because it takes an even more insidious form when your stock is overpriced. You know, I mean, especially in the last few years before this correction and leading into it, there were lots of companies, especially tech companies, who felt that the market had become over exuberant with their stock. The stock had been pushed up. So once in a while, I CFO of a company, of one of these companies would call me and say, look, I have a problem. And this is, and he'll tell me upfront, don't tell anybody we had this conversation, just between you and I. And I won't, that's why I won't name the CFO of the company. He says, look, I think my stock is vastly overpriced. And the stock's trading at 100, it should really be at 15. And then he'd ask me a question, should I go out and issue as many shares as I can right now? Because investors are overpricing my shares. Essentially, he says, should I take advantage of the fact that there's a market mistake in my favor? What do you think the right answer to that is? I mean, should you, if you feel that your stock is overpriced, let's say Zoom right now believes that people have become overexuberant about the company. And they know, should they go out and raise fresh equity? I mean, after all, it's not their fault that people are overexuberant. Should they go out and raise fresh equity? Barry, you said depends on goal. You know, what do you mean by that?
If you want to build long-term reputation, then you don't want to get in shareholders like an opportunist.
So you're saying there's a downside to issuing shares at too high a price. When the correction hits, they're going to blame you, saying, you know, you issued all those shares. That's true, right?
If you have a short-term horizon, then maybe you'd want to issue the stocks because this is the best for the company.
Yeah. If you need the money, if you Zoom, let's face it, you have a huge amount of capital requirements for the next few years because you want to grow faster, right? You need capital. If you need capital, my advice to CFOs is, if you need the capital, go out and issue these shares. It's not your job to set the stock price and talk down the price. If you need the capital to take projects, go out and raise equity. If you don't need the capital, then don't go and play this game of, I'm going to issue the shares and raise the cash, because two things happen. One is this reputation effect, which is when the stock price collapses, all those investors who bought your shares at that high price are going to blame you. The second is, you know, if you have a lot of cash that you don't have a need for, you know what tends to happen? You do stupid things. Like what? You do a big acquisition because cash burns a hole in your pocket. So if you feel there's a market mistake in your favor, don't overthink this. If you need the money to take projects, to take investments, go out and raise the money. But if you don't need the money, don't try to take advantage of shareholders, because these shareholders are going to be your shareholders. They're owners of your company. And you don't want to deliberately take advantage of them by selling them shares at way above what you think the stock should be worth. It's kind of a nuanced answer because it's not a yes or a no. But I think that it's something that factors in. So ignore this page because this is a summary of the last six pages. If you think about the steps involved in designing debt, it always starts with the company and its projects. You design the perfect debt. Then you stop and make sure you maximize your tax benefits. Then you look to see whether you can keep these different interest groups happy by designing the financing in a way that they're all okay with it. Then you sugarcoat the debt if you feel bondholders won't buy your bonds, either because you have the wrong history or you have no history. And then as you get ready to issue the debt, you make sure you don't lock in market mistakes that work against you. If you think about this as the process, you can do some really good things at companies if you think through the process. My problem with a lot of financing solutions that are offered either by consulting firms or banks is they come out of cookbooks. What I mean by cookbooks is every company is given the same recipe. Do this, this, and this. It's worked for every other company. True capital structure advice comes from looking at the company and listening to managers, listening to what they tell you about projects, listening to what they worry about, because if you can design debt that captures those worries, you've done a good thing for the company. You've reduced default risk, allowed them to borrow money, and allowed them to survive through downturns because you want to build a long-term sustainable company. Any questions about the process? Because I'm now going to go to the mechanics of how I would put this into play, and I'll use Disney. But before I do that, I want to make sure that that people are clear about the intuition of the steps in this process. Okay, so now let's talk about, in practice, how would this work at a company? There are three ways you can design debt for your company. The first is intuitive, and to me, this is my favorite approach because it's creative, it makes you think about the company and their businesses, and it's built around And it's built around understanding what a company does. Okay? The second is, I'm going to go back to my capital budgeting and show how you can use those same cash flows that you did to do a net present value to come up with the right debt for a project. And the third is using historical data on macroeconomic variables, interest rates, inflation, and seeing how your company has been affected them and using that information to design the perfect debt for your company. So let's start with the first of these approaches, pure intuition. You tell me what you do as a company, I can pretty much tell you what the right kind of debt for your company is. Let's take Disney. Disney is in five different, it was in five different businesses in 2013. With each business, I'll describe what a typical project in that business looks like and then design debt for that part of the business. First business Disney is in is movies. A typical movie project tends to be short term, right? It tends to have cash flows, at least in 2013, that was still primarily in US dollars, though that's starting to shift, especially with the Avengers movies. And have net cash flows that are heavily driven by whether the movie is a hit or not. So short term, heavily dollar, at least in the US, was still heavily, in 2013, it was heavily dollar driven. And have cash flows that are going to be driven by whether this is a movie that's a hit. Because the movie business is a very skewed business. There are a few movies that are huge hits and lots of movies that just tread water. So if I were designing debt for a movie company, a pure movie company, let's say Lionsgate is my company, it'd probably be short term. It doesn't make sense for me to issue 20-year debt if I'm Lionsgate. The debt should reflect where I make my money. So if Hunger Games is my franchise, and I make 60% of my revenues in the US, 30% in Europe, and 10% in Asia, my currency for my debt should reflect that mix. And if possible, I'd like to tie the coupon rate on the debt to how well the movie does in terms of, you know, gate receipts at movie theaters. You're saying that can't be done. You know, that's going to be impossible to do. Hey, if you were creative, it's amazing what you can do. Have you ever heard of Bowie once? You've heard of David Bowie, right? David Bowie, rock star, recently died. In the early 1990s, David Bowie had an issue with this recording company. So he actually bought back the rights to all of his music from the recording company, which left him with a cash flow problem. Rock star, cash flow problem, those two don't go together because you got three houses and six Rolls Royces to kind of keep going. So here's what David Bowie did. He went to a banker in New York, and that banker devised a very clever solution. He issued bonds against Bowie's music. And what made these bonds unique is the coupon rate of the bond was tied to how many records David Bowie sold. So David Bowie sold millions of records. And remember, those days you actually sold records. It wasn't, you know, streaming. So millions of records, the coupon rate would be 12%. But if he sold, if we all woke up tomorrow and we said, David Bowie, spiky hair, strange guy, I don't like his music, and nobody bought records, the coupon rate actually fell to 0%. You've designed debt that basically captures how your cash flows move. So the movie business, short-term, mixed currencies, and if possible, tied to how well the movie does. Let's take a broadcasting business. Typical project again is short term, because even if you have a series going, it usually goes 2 or 3 years, so it's short term. It's primarily, at least in 2013, was in dollars. Today that might be different. And it's driven by ratings, not bond ratings, but Nielsen ratings, right? So if you have high Nielsen ratings, and again, this is starting to change given how the broadcasting business is changing, my debt would be short term, primarily dollar driven, and if possible, tied to how well the show does. Now, theme park business. Of all of Disney's businesses, this is the longest term business. It's very long term. It's the currency would be a function of where the theme park is being built because it draws different crowds in different parts of the world. And it's going to be affected by the success of my movies, at least at the margin. So if I were designing debt for the theme park business, it's going to be long term debt. The currency is going to reflect where the theme park is located and perhaps be tied to how well my movie business is doing. For the consumer product business, projects are likely to be short-term or medium-term, maybe even long-term. For Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse, they're not going to go out of style. So the debt should be reflect what consumer products come out. And in 2013, Disney had this interactive gaming business. And the interactive gaming business was a risky technology business. So the debt should be short-term, perhaps even convertible, because there's a lot of growth in this business. Now, let me ask you a question. Given how I've designed debt for these six businesses, or for these five businesses, let's move up to 2020. Disney's biggest hope right now for growth is the streaming business, right? So if you were designing debt for Disney's streaming business, what kind of debt would it be? Let's start with maturity, short term or long term. You know, what currency? And now, how would I design debt for the movie business? Rukshan, or Sarah, go ahead. Can you step in and tell me how you would design debt for the
Yeah, I mean, I think I would make it short term because, unlike the parks and the resorts where that's a long term business, you just don't know how long the streaming business is going to be successful for Disney. Mixed currency debt based on where they're going to be launching. So, I think they're starting in the US, but if they move to any other markets, it would be mixed currency. And then, as far as the success, I think so much of their streaming business is connected to the other assets that they have for entertainment. The fact that all the Marvel movies are on there, all the like Disney Princess movies are on there. So, potentially tied to the success of their other brands as well.
I mean, I think that the one pushback I would have, I would have is it is a subscriber-based business. And one of the things about subscriber-based businesses is human beings seem to be, acts of, actually removing a subscription seems to take too much work for most people. So it's subscriber businesses are more stable than transaction businesses. So one of the things that Disney might look at is how stable their base subscription. So they can predict that, Disney, I think last week reported 55 million subscribers. Let's say they believe 30 million of these subscribers are here to stay. And that risk can go up and down depending on what happens. A portion of the debt, I think, can reflect the stability of the subscription business. But I think the rest of your discussion actually makes sense. It's tied to the success of movies. If you can somehow design debt, I mean, I would make, if you can even make it a convertible debt where the conversion option is tied to how well the streaming business is doing, you'll be designing debt that is right for the streaming business. Now, for Disney, designing the perfect debt might be less critical because it's a business, it's a company in multiple businesses. So there's within business risk that's spreading across the company. But if you are a pure streaming company like Netflix, designing the right debt is much more critical than for a company that has some kind of diversification across multiple businesses. So, but I think we're on the right track here with thinking about the company, the project, and building up to it. Sam, you have a question or a comment?
I'm confused when we're saying that tying the success of movies to the debt, it's conceptually at odds with the idea that if a company is more successful in that its rating it reflects that success, then it would pay us a lower coupon because of the credibility of the company. So
No,
would
no, no, no. What you're saying is before you release the movie, you don't know whether it's going to be a success or a failure, right? One of the reasons that you don't borrow money is you're afraid if you issue debt and your movies turn out to be failures. Let's take Lionsgate, perfect example, because it's a pure movie business. Let's say Lionsgate can borrow money right now. They have the income to borrow money, but what's holding them back is the income is volatile. It depends on how successful the movies are. So you know what Lionsgate is going to do? It's not going to borrow money. It's going to stay at a 0 or a 10% debt ratio because it's wary about issuing debt and then getting into trouble.
I
So
got
what
it.
Lionsgate can then do is issue debt where the coupon rate is tied to the success of the movie. This
Yeah,
way,
okay.
you can borrow the money, get the tax benefit, but if the movie crashes and burns, they're not going bankrupt. So in hindsight, you're always going to regret issuing this debt if you're successful. You're saying, hey, if I hadn't issued the, basically you're going to say,
It's an
look,
op, yeah.
but it protects you against default.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay. So that's the intuitive approach. So what I'd like you to do is take your company. This is my in session now. You have a company you're doing a new project and intuitively think through what the right debt for your company is. If your company is in multiple businesses, think about what the right debt. Now, Sam mentions it limits upside potential. Absolutely. There's no free lunch, right? Because it does mean that you're going to share the upside with the bondholders, but you also reduce default risk. So that's the trade-off, and you're accepting the trade-off because you get the tax benefits in return for the trade-off. So with your company, design the perfect debt, right? What duration, what currency, fixed or floating rate, straight or convertible. And if you can get creative and think about what you would add on, go ahead. You're saying, but no, my company is so small, there wouldn't be a market for this specialized debt. Remember Bowie bonds, there was a market for that debt. Now sometimes you got to design the perfect debt for your company to realize there's a potential for a market. That's how Lou Ranieri realized there was a market for mortgage-backed securities. Is he said, wouldn't it be neat if we could have a debt, you know, where you could take these mortgages and convert them into a fixed income security? And he did. So sometimes being aware of a need can be the first step in designing a new security. So that's the intuitive approach. Any question? No. So Rizwan, the question about fixed and floating is driven by pricing power, and straight and convertible is driven by whether you have growth potential or not. So if you're a mature company, you go with straight debt. If you're a growth company, convertible debt works better for you. So that's what drives fixed, floating, straight, or convertible. Emily?
Yeah, I have a simple question. So no matter what structure of financing we have designed, will there always be the products from the financier side to suit our need?
No, not necessarily. That's why I said sometimes the market might not be there to issue the security, in which case you might have to issue a bond that's not right for you, but then you can create your own complex security, right? By using futures and options. We have so many choices now. No, so if that security doesn't exist and the banker says, no, I can't create something like that, you might issue a bond that's not right for you, and then use derivatives to create this kind of complex security. So if you wanted to, you could create this. It's nice to have a market where you can issue a floating rate convertible bond or whatever is right for you. But if it doesn't exist, you might have to do a little more work, but you can get there. It might be a little more expensive to do because you're building it yourself, but it's doable.
Oh, and what is the main form for us to secure the structure that we want? Is that the legal document?
Basically, that's what it'll be. Every corporate bond comes with covenants, right? Constraints. So the design of the bond is a contractual commitment. So it is a legal document. If it's a bank, it's a bank loan document.
Okay, thank you.
So now let's move on to the second way in which you can design the perfect debt. Remember when we did capital budgeting, we projected out the cash flows for a project. We came up with a discount rate, we discounted back and came up with the net present value. We did this for the Disney theme park, if you remember. And if you can come up with the cash flows for a project, you can also talk about what the right kind of debt for that project is. Let me use the Disney theme park to illustrate. This is actually from the first packet when I did my cash flows. Those are my cash flows in the project. There's my terminal value. There's my traditional net present value. So if I stop at the fourth column, the net present value of 3.3 billion is what we got as the net present value for the project. I don't know whether you remember computing the duration for a bond in foundations. You know, you probably covered it, you might have forgotten about it. But the way you compute a simple duration, it's called Macaulay duration, is you take your present value in each period and multiply it by whichever year you get the cash flow. So your present value in year one is minus 922. I multiply by one, I get minus 922. I get my net present value at minus 730 in year two. I multiply by two, I get minus 1460. I do this for every year. I add up that last column, I come up with 62,355. You say, what the heck does that even mean? Hang in there. If I divide the 62,355 by 3,296, I come up with 18.9. That is my duration for this project. It's embedded in every capital budgeting analysis. We never use it, but if you ask me to compute the duration for a project, I could compute a duration, and the duration is 18.92 years. You say, what does that mean? If I were issuing debt specifically for this project, and I wanted to issue the perfect debt for this project, it should have a duration of roughly 19 years. You know what that will translate into? A 30-year bond has a duration of roughly 16, 17, 18 years. So I would have to issue 35-year bonds, 40-year bonds, if my objective were just matching up the debt to a specific project. In the case of Disney, I would never do this because they have multiple projects and multiple businesses, and this is a very expensive way of designing debt for each project. But if I'm a toll road company that takes big toll road projects, and I have only two or three projects every year, this might be the way I design the right debt, is go with the cash flows of the project and design the debt for that project based on the cash flows. Because I know what currency the cash flows are in, I can now compute the duration for the project and compute the debt duration to match up the duration for the project. So any questions about either the mechanics of what I'm doing or what I'm doing after I've computed the duration? No questions? So it's just an extension of the capital. Sam asks, can a firm issue project-specific bonds? Absolutely. Disney has done it. In fact, Disney has issued Little Mermaid bonds. It really did in the late 90s. You know, tied to its revenues and income from the Little Mermaid movie, you know, whatever products came out of the movie. A company can issue project-specific bonds, and the bonds are then secured by the cash flows of the project. It usually doesn't make sense to do it because it is, you know, then you're managing all these multiple bonds. But if you have a franchise, which is almost a solid cash flow, even a Marvel would be a great, can you imagine Avengers bonds? I just buy it just for the name of the bond. Any other questions on project specific bonds? So now let's talk about the third way you can design debt. It's going to get a little statistical, so hang in there here because there's some very neat tools that can come out of this. Remember what I'm trying to do is design debt where the cash flows and the debt move up when the cash flows for my company are high and the cash flows and the debt are low when my cash flows of the company are low. Well, one way you can see what drives the cash flows of your company is to look at the past, right? Look to see what the cash flows of your company looked like last year, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, as a function of what macroeconomic variables are doing, how the economy is doing, how interest rates are doing, how inflation is doing. So what you're looking at is first your history as a company, both in terms of operating income and cash flows and market value as a company. So you look at it over time. And the second is you're looking at macroeconomic variables over time. So let's say Disney. For Disney, I looked at 1985 through 2013. I looked at the operating income every year and the enterprise value every year. Remember, enterprise value is market value of equity plus debt minus cash. It's a rough measure of market value of operations. And I computed the percentage change in operating income and the percentage change in enterprise value every year from 1985 through 2013. So the last two columns are how Disney's operating income and company value have done by year over time. You say, what am I going to do with this? Here's what I also did. I looked up four separate macroeconomic variables, and I'll explain with each one why I care. I looked up how much T-bond rates changed every year, how much GDP, real GDP, so how the US economy is doing every year. So basically this is the percentage change in GDP. When that number is a big positive number, the economy is booming. When that number is negative or low, the economy is not doing well. I looked at the percentage change in CPI, that's the inflation rate and how it's moving over time, and the percentage change in the dollars. The dollar is strengthening or weakening. So positive number, the dollar is strengthening, and negative number, the dollar is weakening. So how interest rates are changing, how GDP is changing, how inflation is changing, how the US dollar is changing. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to look to see how Disney is affected as interest rates change, how Disney is affected as GDP changes, how Disney is affected as inflation changes, and how Disney is affected as the dollar strengthens or weakens. And I'll give you the rationale with each macroeconomic variable as to why I'm looking, and then I'm going to look at the data to see what it tells me. First, let's look at how sensitive Disney's operating income and firm value are to changes in the T-bond rate. You're saying, what's this going to tell me? I'm going to argue that looking at how Disney's firm value changes, especially firm value changes, as interest rate changes, is going to give me a rough measure of the duration of Disney's assets. You're saying, how the heck is it going to do that? I'll explain in a moment, but basically if I can see how Disney's firm value is changing as interest rates change, I can tell you whether Disney's assets are long-term or short-term and whether it should be using 10-year debt or 20-year debt or 30-year debt or 5-year debt. So let me explain how this is going to work. I ran a regression of changes in Disney's firm value against changes in the T-bond rate. Remember that column I showed you earlier, the T-bond rate column? So basically, I'm taking the changes in firm value, this column, and running a regression against changes in the T-bond rate. You say, what the heck is it going to do for me? So when I did this, I came up with a coefficient of -2.33 on the change in interest rates. No red flag, my T statistic is close to zero. So it's not statistically significant, but let's leave it there for the moment. But that coefficient means for every 1% increase in the T bond rate, Disney's firm value drops by 2.33%. So hold on to that thought. Interest rates go up, Disney's firm value decreases. Here's why I think that coefficient means something. Remember we talked about the duration of a bond and asked you, do you remember how it was done? Assuming you'd remember some of what was done, the duration of a bond looks at not just the average maturity when your cash flows come in. That's one way to read it. It also measures the percentage change in the bond price for a change in interest rate. So basically, when you say the duration of a bond is 8, you're saying for every 1% move in interest rates, my bond price moves 8%. So duration of a bond roughly measures how much the bond price moves for a given change in interest rates. You remember what the regression did? Basically, this regression tells me for a given change in interest rates, how much does my firm value change? In a rough way, a regression gives me the same answer as running that bond duration calculation. It gives me the duration of my assets. You're saying, why would I run a regression? Because it's much more difficult computing the duration of a company's assets using this bond duration formula. So what I'm using is a regression to come up with an answer of what is the duration of my company's assets. So with a bond, you compute duration using the expected coupons and the face value. But when I ask you to compute the duration of a company's assets, a shortcut you can use is to run that regression of how much is my company value changing as interest rates change. That coefficient that you get on the regression, that -2.33 that I got for Disney, becomes a rough measure of the duration of Disney's assets. Let me pause right there because I know I threw a lot at you there. But running a regression of how much does my company's value change as interest rates change gives me a rough measure of, you know, of what the duration of the assets is. Now, I'm going to run simple regressions for the moment. So rather than run a multiple regression and have my coefficients give me multiple messages, I'm going to run the regression against each macro variable separately. Because each macro variable, I'm getting an answer to a different question. So running a regression of changes in firm value against changes in interest rates gives me a rough measure of the duration of my assets. I also ran the regression of operating income against changes in interest rates. And here I got a much stronger effect. Every 1% increase in interest rates reduces my Disney's operating income by 7.93%. Higher interest rates hurt Disney's operating income and firm value. But the firm value regression gives me a measure of the duration of the assets. This just tells me how sensitive my operating income is to higher interest rates. Okay. So now let's move to the second variable. I ran a regression of Disney's firm value and operating income against GDP. You're saying, what is this going to tell me? Okay. The R-squared chain asked me about the R-squareds. The R-squareds are low, the T statistics are bad. I'll tell you that up front, and I'll tell you my solution at the end. But they're not going to be great looking regressions. So I ran a regression of Disney's firm value and operating income against GDP. You're saying, what does that tell me? Remember, one of the questions we often have with the company is my company a cyclical company? How cyclical is it? And people have all these rules of thumb. One simple measure of cyclicality is to run this regression of your company's firm value and operating income against what the GDP is doing. Because if you have a cyclical company, here's what you should see. When the GDP is rising strongly, your company should be doing much better. When the GDP is dropping, your company should do badly. So the coefficient on real GDP should be a big positive number if you're a cyclical company. It should be close to zero if you're a non-cyclical company. And if it's negative, Your company is actually a counter-cyclical company. It does well during recessions and does badly during booms. There are very few of those companies, but that's why this regression matters. So I ran the regression of Disney's firm value, that's the first regression, and operating income against GDP. I get strong positive coefficients in both, and here the t-statistics are significant. So what does that tell me? It tells me that Disney overall as a company is a cyclical company. How I would incorporate that into my debt design, I'm not sure yet, because it might mean that I borrow less money overall because I'm a cyclical company. Or if I can somehow create bonds that allow me to kind of build that cyclicality in, I'm going to try to do it. So running the regression of firm value and operating income against GDP is going to tell me whether my company is a cyclical company. Let me pause there. Any questions? So interest rate regressions tell me something about the duration of my assets. The GDP regression is going to tell me something about cyclicality. Olivia.
Is there a difference between being a company being counter-cyclical and defensive?
And what?
Classified as a defensive company?
No, it's the same thing. A defensive company is either as non-cyclical. I told you it's very difficult to find counter-cyclical companies. So most people, when they talk about defensive investments, are talking about companies that are either non-cyclical, but if you can find counter-cyclical, even better. Okay. So defensive is an investment term. Cyclical and counter-cyclical is just more generally a term we use to see how my company moves with the economy. One of the things you might consider doing is I've focused on US GDP growth, but as companies get global, maybe these regressions need to be run with global GDP growth. Okay. Rizwana?
I just coming back to Perry's point, when we're sort of regressing the firm value against variables, against a single variable, then won't the error term just be too large? Don't we have to factor in all the variables when running this regression?
Well, remember, when you run multiple regressions, do you remember what has to be true about the independent variables?
Should be exogenous.
Exactly. Is there any chance that GDP growth, inflation, interest rates, and the US dollar are going to be independent of each other, you'll have a mess in a multiple regression. The individual coefficients will be almost impossible to read because of it.
Got it. Thank you.
That's why I'm running them as separate regressions.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions about GDP? So third regression I ran was when I took Disney's firm value changes and operating income changes and ran the regression against the US dollar. And so what the measure I use is called the weighted US dollar. Basically, it's rather than run it against individual currencies, the weighted US dollar is a trade weighted index of how the dollar is doing against multiple currencies. It's actually available on the Federal Reserve site, FRED, which I've talked about before, and I'll send you a link if you're interested. So it gives you the number it reports it by day. You can get how the dollar is doing on a weighted basis against different currencies. So I want to run a regression of Disney's firm value and operating income against a weighted dollar. You're saying, what's it going to tell me? If I get a positive coefficient on this regression, that means a stronger dollar helps Disney. It increases their operating income. It increases their firm value. If I get a zero coefficient, Disney's unaffected by what happens to the dollar. If I get a negative coefficient, a stronger dollar actually hurts Disney as a company. So before I even show you the regression, what do you think the relationship is going to be for Disney? Is a stronger dollar, you think, going to help Disney, hurt Disney, or leave it unaffected?
Help Disney?
Help Disney, you said?
Yeah.
Okay, so tell me what happens if you have a stronger dollar.
Like?
All your foreign operations, what happens?
Your income?
No.
It's your income,
but Disney also makes a lot of money from people coming to its theme parks in the US, right? If you look at it, at one point in time, I think 35% of the tourists coming into Disney World were coming from Latin America, and about 30% of the tourists coming to Disneyland were coming from Asia. When you have a stronger dollar, your revenues in the theme parks are going to be affected because fewer people are going to come. So Disney's, they're going to be mixed effects. Some of the businesses are going to be helped. Some of the businesses are going to be hurt. Overall, let's see what the effect is, because it can cut both ways. It looks like a stronger dollar hurts Disney more in its operating income than its firm value. And so you can, that's why I run both regressions. So Disney's operating income seems to be hurt when the dollar gets stronger. The stronger dollar seems to hurt it more than help it. But firm value is also hurt, but hurt less than operating income is. So the bottom line here is, if you see the dollar strengthen, Disney's value, so you're saying, how does that help me in designing debt? If I make all my debt US dollar debt, it's a bad thing, because you can see a stronger dollar kind of works out my operating income. So this is one of those cases where if you get a zero coefficient on the dollar, you can basically design your debt to be in US dollars. You're saying, look, a dollar strengthens or weakens, my cash flows are not affected. But if you get a negative or a positive coefficient, that's a signal to you that you should be designing your debt around that relationship. In this case, I would argue that this tells me that more of Disney's debt needs to be in foreign currencies, because they are affected by a stronger dollar. Their operating income firm value are reduced when the dollar gets stronger. So this is, again, something I could have got by looking at where my revenues are coming from, but I think it is a function of, you know, what you find by looking at the actual data. My final regression, any questions about what the dollar regression tells you? Okay. Final regression, I ran my regression of Disney's firm value and operating income against changes in inflation. You're saying, what is this going to tell me? You know what it's going to tell me? Whether Disney has pricing power. And here's why. If you have pricing power, here's what you should say. When inflation goes up, you should be able to pass it through to your customers, and your income should also go up. If inflation goes down, you should be, you should expect to see your operating income and firm value increase when inflation goes up and decrease when inflation goes down. That's your pricing power. If you don't have pricing power, here's what's going to happen. If inflation goes up, your costs will go up, but your income will go down because you can't pass it through. So if you get a positive coefficient on this regression, I would argue it shows you that your pricing power. If you get a negative coefficient, it basically means that you don't have pricing power. Why does that matter? It's going to tell me whether I can issue floating rate debt. So let's see what the answer is for Disney. Disney has very strong pricing power when it comes to operating income. Look at that coefficient. Every 1% increase in the inflation rate, my operating income increases by 8.19%. This statistic is strong. The effect on value is also positive, but much weaker. The T statistic is less than one. So basically, what does that mean? Disney is able to pass through inflation into its operating income. Since I have to service interest expense from operating income, it means that Disney is a pretty good candidate for floating rate debt. So if I were to summarize what these regressions have told me, it tells me that Disney's assets collectively have a duration of about 2.33 years. So looking across its businesses, Disney is a company, its debt should be relatively short term. It is cyclical because both its operating income and firm value seem to be affected by GDP. They both increase and decrease with GDP. It is hurt by a stronger dollar, and its operating income tends to move with inflation, so it tends to have pricing power. So if I were designing debt for Disney around these factors, these findings would drive me towards designing the debt that matches the company. But the caveat, as I showed you all of these regressions, was I admitted up front, the regressions are terrible, the R-squareds are low, the T-statistics are bad. Does it remind you of something else we ran a regression to get? Now, what was the other big number we've been using in corporate finance that came out of a regression? Beta, right? We said regressions look awful, the betas, you know, a big standard error. And what was our solution to the fact that the individual regressions had a lot of noise? What did we do there to counter it? We did a bottom-up beta. We used the law of large numbers. Hey, wouldn't it be neat if I took entertainment companies and I ran these regressions for every entertainment company? And I reported not just what Disney's numbers look like, but what the average, the bottom up. That's exactly what I've done in this table. It was a pain in the neck. I'll be quite honest. I do these regressions once every 10 years because this is not like running my bottom-up beta regressions. I can't code S&P Capital IQ. This, I had to run the regressions by hand for every company. But what I have here are the bottom-up estimates for my interest rate regression, GDP. So basically, I took all broadcasting companies, all theme park companies, ran the regressions for each company against interest rate, GDP growth, inflation, and currency. And these are my bottom-up estimates. And then I took a bottom-up average for Disney. So this is my bottom-up duration for Disney's assets, my bottom-up estimates of how sensitive it is to GDP, my bottom-up estimates of inflation and currency. And at least with the duration, I think this number, 4.34, is a much more reliable number than the 2.33 that I got by running just the Disney regression. So think of this as the analog to bottom-up betas with the macro variables. I won't ask you to do these bottom-up numbers by yourself. It's too much of a pain. I'll send you my, you know, the last time I did this was about 5 years ago. I'll send you those old numbers. If you want, you can look at them. I'm not going to make you even run through these kinds of regressions for your company. Now, though I have a spreadsheet that will do that for you because you get so much noise in your regressions. But if I were to summarize what I've found with these macro regressions, here's what I would view as my summary. I would expect Disney's debt to have a duration of roughly 4.3 years, which is a maturity of maybe 6 years, 5.5 to 6 years. I would expect a significant portion of the debt to be floating rate debt. Why? Because Disney's income and value are affected by a dollar, because Disney has pricing power. I'm sorry, floating rate debt because it has pricing power. Remember that inflation regression. And I would expect a significant portion of Disney's debt to be foreign currency debt. Partly because I know 18% of its revenues come from outside the US, and partly because of what the regression told me about how Disney is affected by the dollar. So that's what I expect Disney's debt to be. I took a look at Disney's actual debt. Disney's actual debt has an average maturity of 7.92 years, duration of about 6 years. So if I were to pass a conclusion, its debt is probably a little too long term, but not by, if it were 15 or 20 years, I'd be worried. But the difference is fairly small. It has only about 5% of its debt in non-US, in foreign currencies. That strikes me as too low. I mean, both given the 18% of revenues it gets outside the US and how sensitive its numbers are to the US dollar. I would expect more foreign currency debt. And only about 6% of their debt is floating rate debt. Given their pricing power, I'd expect that number to be higher as well. So here's my bottom line. I would expect Disney's debt to be a little less long-term, a little more foreign currency, and a little more floating rate debt. So let's say I were asked by Disney, can we do this fix? One way you do it, and this was 30 or 40 years ago, this might have been the only way to do it, is to pay off a big chunk of your debt and issue new debt. But that's so costly. But there are shortcuts now you can use, right? One is, you can do swaps. One of the good things about having swaps available to you, you know how a swap works, right? You take fixed rate US dollar debt and you swap it for foreign currency euro debt. Disney can do that. But there's also another way in which Disney can get back to set. Disney's not done issuing debt. They're building new theme parks, they're making new movies, they're expanding, they're doing acquisitions, and they choose what debt to take on those new projects. I would recommend that they use a disproportionately large amount of floating rate foreign currency debt on those acquisitions and new investments, because ultimately it's about Disney as a company. So you can either swap and adjust your existing debt or use your new debt to get to steady state. But I think this is an opportunity in many companies, is when you think about the perfect debt, you look at the actual debt, you say the actual debt doesn't make sense for this company. Think about how you would fix that mismatch. So for Disney, at least, that would be my conclusion based on my analysis. Little less long-term, much more floating rate, much more foreign currency debt. And I want you to think in those same terms for your company when you look at the actual debt and say, is that debt the right debt for my company? Any questions on my Disney analysis?
Hi, Professor. So
yes.
That inflation generally tends to be positive. And for a company like Disney, wouldn't it be kind of advantageous to just have fixed rate debt because, you know, their income goes up, but their commitments well, remain?
It's not a question of whether inflation is positive, but whether it's variable, right? Let's say inflation is 3% this year, 7% next year, 5% the year after, 11% the year after. It's always positive every single year, but it's moving around. If you have pricing power, then basically you can adjust your prices to reflect whatever the inflation is. Whereas if you go out and lock in fixed rate debt and you have pricing power, you're giving away too much. I think part of what's driving your view is we're at a level of rates where you're saying it makes no sense for me to issue floating rate debt. Because you're bringing an interest rate view. And I'm not saying you're wrong. Maybe that'll drive your choice right now. But in a more general scenario, I think you want to be careful about locking in fixed rate debt because you might be paying a rate that's much higher than the rate you should be paying if inflation falls off. So if you have pricing power, generally speaking, floating rate debt is a better choice, but we might be in a very special interest rate environment where you override that.
Okay, thank you.
Rizwana?
When calculating the duration of Disney of Disney's debt, I'm guessing you did the ran the regression against interest rate. So for our companies, how do we then calculate the interest rate without running a regression? Is there any other method?
No, there is another way, right? Which is the intuitive way. If your company, I'll give you a very simple example. We can do Walmart's duration pretty simply. Why? What's a typical project for Walmart? Another store, right? And if you think about another store, you can tell me it's a 15-year lease and a 15-year lease. So basically, if you have a company that takes the same kind of project over and over, and that's why I think in one of the earlier sections, I asked you to think about a typical project for your company. If your company is the kind of company that takes the same kind of project over and over, understanding what that project looks like will give you an answer to the duration of your debt.
Okay.
Now let's talk about Bookscape and Vale and see what kind of, and here I'm going to stick purely with the intuition because I ran the regressions with these regressions gave me almost complete noise. Bookscape, it's a private bookstore, it's one bookstore, and I know the lease on the store. And I think actually operating leases make complete sense for retailers as the right kind of debt. It's locked into the store, it's matched up to how long you're going to stay in the store. There's a reason operating leases have evolved as the way of financing for retailers and restaurants. It matches up to your cash flows. For Vale, a typical project is long-term. It's dollar-denominated because they're a commodity company and you sell into a dollar-based market. And if you could design the perfect debt, you'd probably tie your coupon rates to iron ore prices, right? Vale probably wished it had done this in 2008-09. The existing debt at Vale is primarily dollar debt, so that's pretty much what you'd expect. Long duration, average maturity of 15 years. But there's been no attempt to tie it to iron ore prices. Maybe commodity companies need to think more seriously, especially after the last decade, about tying coupon rates to commodity prices. Yeah. Now, any questions about the Bookscape and Vale debt design? So those were pretty simple examples. Tata Motors, a typical project, is another manufacturing plant, probably medium to long term. It should probably be fixed rate debt at least for their Tata portion of the business, because they don't have much pricing power for their cars in India. Maybe floating rate debt for the Jaguar Land Rover, where you do have more pricing power coming from brand name. The existing debt at Tata Motors is about 71% Indian rupee debt, 29% mostly euro debt taken by Jaguar Land Rover. And maybe that should be re-examined as Jaguar Land Rover becomes a bigger and bigger part of Tata Motors. Is maybe the kind of debt that should be issued should reflect that. Maybe more floating rate debt as Jaguar Land Rover becomes a bigger part of Tata Motors. And Baidu, it's very little debt to begin with. If I were designing the perfect debt for Baidu, given that it gets all of its revenues in China and it's a technology company, I'd probably make it convertible Chinese yuan debt. Their actual debt is primarily fixed rate debt and not in Chinese currencies. So I think that with Baidu, there's a mismatch and maybe there's a good reason for the mismatch. Maybe they can borrow at a lower rate outside China, but they need to use futures or options or derivatives to manage that mismatch. The debt is clearly mismatched. So when you do debt design, that's what you're trying to do, is you're trying to design the perfect debt for your company based either on intuition or with the tools we have, looking at a project and looking at the cash flows. And then looking at the actual debt, saying that, does that debt make sense? So that's the last page for your third quiz. So are there any questions on the debt design part? So don't lose sight of the end game. If you're trying to design debt that's right for your company, where the cash flows and the debt move with the cash flows and your assets. All of these tools are just tools. Don't let the tools drive the process. Think of the end game. Shashankar.
Yeah, so a couple of things. We talked about how ideally, Disney should, for the movies business, it should tie the coupon to the...
I said if it were a pure movie company, that's what would make sense. As companies get more diversified, you almost get an intra-business mix of, you know, there's a diversification that can cut across. It becomes less critical that you match perfectly. Then you can say what's right for the company, rather than try to match up individual businesses.
Yeah, but first, even for Vale, you said, you know, ideally it's commodity linked coupon. One first question is I don't think that's very common though, right? In the bond market, if I'm not mistaken.
Not common, because I'll tell you why, because commodity companies think they're better at forecasting commodity prices than investors are. And if you think you're better, then you're never going to issue commodity-linked bonds, right? Because you say, I'm the one with the expertise. Same reason. Big insurance companies don't sell catastrophe bonds. You know why? Because they think they can assess the risk of a catastrophe better than typical investors are. And insurance companies are probably right. That's all they do. So as long as you believe you're a little better at doing this than the typical investor, you're never going to turn over that power into a bond. So this actually, you find smaller commodity companies, smaller insurance companies, which are more worried about defaulters doing it. Because if you don't have a lot of debt, you will never do this. ExxonMobil has so little debt that tying the debt to the oil price doesn't make sense for ExxonMobil. Shale oil company in Texas with 50% debt, should have been doing this all along. So that's going to play out as well, right? How much debt do you have? How big are you? How much do you feel you can forecast this better than the typical investor can?
The flip side is there demand from bond investors or lenders to do that? Because aren't the bond investors in it because they want fixed payments?
But bond market is a big market, right? So don't you think there's a subset of investors who want to bet on commodity prices and hold bonds at the same time? I mean, I think the only way to Lou Ranieri suggested a mortgage-backed security market, you know what the response was? Why would people buy bonds tied to real estate? And people discovered that there was a big market for it. So sometimes the only way to find out if there's a market is to actually create the bond and see what the demand is. And there have been commodity-linked bonds for a long time, right? People have bought them. So there's clearly a market. There's enough investors for that market to be sustained. You might say, how big can that market be? Hey, who knows? After this oil price fiasco, there might be a lot more players willing to bet on oil prices with their bond. Yeah. Maybe straight bonds are going to be the tough ones to buy.
Okay, thank you.
David?
How do we think about hedging and bonds that would be tied to commodity prices? Are those...
That's actually a good point. You're saying under what conditions should I... Because you can create the equivalent of a commodity bond by issuing a straight bond and doing hedging on the side, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you have short-term exposure, hedging makes more sense. So for instance, for Boeing, I would not recommend building in their currency exposure into their debt. And the reason is very simple. Boeing's currency exposure is constantly shifting depending on who's ordering the airplanes from them. So one year they have a currency exposure in Singapore dollars, the next year their currency exposure is in Indonesian rupiah, the third year it's in Brazilian reais. So there, my recommendation is don't try to build it into your bonds because it's too messy. Issue dollar-based bonds and then use, you know, hedging or, you know, derivatives to take care of exchange rate risk. But if your exposure is constant and long-term, my preference is to build into the bonds because it's less expensive than going out and doing this on a year-to-year basis. So I'm not saying there's no room for forwards and futures and hedging, because there is short-term macro exposure that I can use that those tools for. But the long-term exposure, I think it's better to try to build it into your debt and let it be there because it's less expensive.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. I know we have only 5 minutes left, so I'm going to set up what next week is going to bring in addition to the question. Next week, we're going to turn to the third and final principle in corporate finance, the dividend principle. And there are two pieces to it. The first is every business has to ask, how much cash can I return to my owners? If it's a private business, you're saying, how much cash can I take out of the company without affecting my potential? So this is not cash that you're taking out because you need the cash. It's cash that's left over after you've met every conceivable need. The second question I'm going to ask is, what form should I return that cash? You're saying, what are you talking about? At least for public companies, you can return the cash in the form of dividends. And you can also return the cash in the form of buybacks. So we're going to say dividends versus buybacks. And this is a very, very, very sensitive question right now, because there's this whole group of arguments that have been made that buybacks are what have got airlines and Boeing into trouble. So we're going to talk about a benign perspective on buybacks and a malignant perspective. When can buybacks get into trouble? So next class is going to be about dividends. And as the final page for today, one thing you have to remember is how dividends work in a traditional corporate finance world and what actually happens in practice. So I'll start with this page when we start on Monday, but we're going to move on to that next principle. Jonas question has a question about quiz three. Jonas, do you want to unmute yourself?
Yeah.
So you ask about the schedule. I'm not sure what you mean by the schedule. You're saying,
yeah. So last time it was open, I think it was like 3 a.m. to like 2 p.m.
Did that work for most of you? I mean, I was planning to have something very similar. You know, so basically about 12 hours or so, it'd be a 1 hour quiz, multiple choice, 5 questions. So same setup as last time.
Okay, same time as last time. Okay, good. Thank you.
And if you have, because I was trying to pick a wide enough time zone that if you're in a different time zone, you would not have to wake up at midnight to take it. And I think it worked last time, so I think I'll stay with it.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay, so that's it for today. And the next session, as I said, we will start the dividend section. And if you have the book, basically we're in chapter 10. So we've been, if you don't have the book, don't worry. I'm not trying to freak you out. You don't need the book. But so we're going to be moving into chapters 10 and 11, the dividend section. And if you're reading up in the lecture notes, you can read ahead if you want. But the quiz will cover only the financing principle. Okay. That's it. Thank you. Take care.